From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. Happy Friday. Sorry about my allergies. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Our panel includes Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Mia Maldonado, state politics reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. Everybody, thank you so much. I know it's a crazy week. Really appreciate you being here. Happy Friday.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Crazy week. Is there something in the news?
Yeah, Logan. Okay. You're it.
Wiener Schnitzel.
Yeah, we'll talk about Wiener Schnitzel. So Idaho legislature is supposed to go home. Didn't. I don't think it is now, from what I've heard from my spies. I've been a little busy prepping for the show. You guys tell me. Let's talk about the Idaho Transportation Department campus sale. I think everybody wrote about this, except you, Mia, and sorry, but you can jump in. So Don, Melissa, Logan, Christina, everybody, lob on here. What is this, first and foremost? What is this campus sale? And then we'll find out why it's falling apart. Who wants to go first? Don't everybody jump on at once. Logan.
Don's kind of the subject matter expert, but I'm happy to talk about the politics.
Logan, you jumped on first, so...
Shouldn't have opened my mouth.
Yep,
all right.
Yep.
Well, let's see. Your Boise audience is probably familiar with the old ITD headquarters on State Street. It's on the corner of State Street and Whitewater. It is a 44-acre property, and I actually talked to Margaret Carmel with Boise Dev on our podcast, on the Idaho Reports podcast, about it this week. The state has been trying for a few years to sell it, and there are a handful of lawmakers who are not happy with that fact, and now that has been tied into the budget for the entire Idaho Transportation Department, as well as a few other pieces of legislation moving through the session. And it is one of many reasons that they are not finished with the session today.
Oh, good wrap up. Don, this property is rather valuable, I understand, or, you know, it's in a nice place.
I mean, based on what I can afford, it's definitely valuable. Yeah. So this site has been something that the city of Boise has long looked at for an area to add housing and other uses close to the downtown core. It's really right on the edge of downtown Whitewater Park Boulevard, close to the river and the North End neighborhood. And there's an urban renewal district that covers the property. And there's long been designs on how this might be a way to add additional housing close to the core. And ITD had long been reluctant to move out of its headquarters building on this site and saw its hand forced really during the COVID pandemic when a leak, really a flood, damaged much of the somewhat historic Philip E. Batt building on the property. Cool. And it finally moved forward to a process to sell it over the summer. Boise commercial firm TOK Commercial was hired to find a buyer, and they got a bunch. And there was all sorts of designs, from a, like, you know, big box shopping center type of an idea to one that would have built a big urban farm area. All these different concepts from a bunch of different developers, and it really came down to three parties, one of which was Boise-based Hawkins Companies, which was ultimately the winning bidder. But as we found in our reporting last fall, they were one of three finalists on the property, and the other two finalists had said, hey, we propose to close quickly. You'll get your money in 60 days. We'll get this moving. But they wanted to pay a little bit less, and so the state decided, you know what, we're going to take this deal from Hawkins Company. It's worth a little bit more money, but it's got a fairly long close time for due diligence and some other things. That is what opened the door to this legislative action, because the deal isn't closed yet. The state still owns the property, and they don't have this signed, sealed, and delivered, as the famous song might say. And so now it has become a political football, which Melissa and Logan are much more equipped to deal with.
A very political hot potato. Christina, I know Clark has been all over this. Can you tell me about the debate yesterday? Or yeah.
Yeah, I think the interesting part about this and why it's elongated the session, the legislators had hoped to be wrapped up by today. The Senate adjourned today until Tuesday, so they're taking that long Easter weekend break. And the votes on this, both in the House and the Senate, were extremely close. This budget only passed the House by one vote, and it went down in the Senate yesterday by three votes. And there's a real difference of opinion between House Speaker Mike Moyle and Senate pro tempore Chuck Winder, who for a long time served actually on the ITD board, and he's also a commercial real estate guy, so he understands the give and take on a big purchase like this. And so I think over the weekend there will have to be a really hammering out of how they're going to solve this problem, because I think both the House and the Senate, and even within the House and even within the Senate, there's a lot of differing opinions on what should be done here, what's fair to the developers, and then the folks that want to keep the building say that this would save the taxpayers of Idaho millions of dollars if they can refurbish this building rather than selling it off and having to move those state employees to a different campus. So we are at a standstill politically on this issue, and it'll be interesting to see when they come back on Tuesday if anything has shifted loose on that.
Can I jump in, Sam?
Please, Logan, do.
There's so much, the window for what could happen is arguably pretty big, depending on if the sale goes through or not. And sitting on the floor of the Senate yesterday before that vote happened, I saw senators literally on their phones doing math, comparing the numbers between selling the property and not selling the property, replacing the building, not replacing the building. People were penciling out the figures on their phones up until the moment, some of them, that they voted yesterday.
Wow. Melissa, did you think at the start of the session that this would become one of the what we call going home problems? Because this, as
Sam,
Logan said, is attached to the ITD budget.
I have long ago given up trying to figure out what the going home issue is going to be. It is always unexpected. And I've given up. Nothing surprises me anymore with the legislature. And I'm not saying that to be disparaging or anything like that. It's just every single session, it's always something like this that we didn't see coming. Though starting, a while ago, we saw signs that the House and the Senate would be divided on this. This is something that Senator Winder feels very, very strongly about. As Christina mentioned, he is the former chair of the ITD board. He is very involved in issues like planning and zoning. He has strong feelings about this, and he's made that clear to reporters repeatedly. So it's not that I'm surprised. Nothing surprises me anymore.
Okay, so as you said, Christina, they've jumped ahead. They're not going to wrap up today. We are going into next week to try and solve this problem. And some other budget bills went down in flames, Melissa, if your notes are correct to me, because or I interpreted them correctly.
Sam, I only give you correct notes.
I know you
I
do,
will just
but
give you an overview real quick, briefly, of what the Senate has voted down this week. The budget for the judiciary went down, was rewritten the next day. The budgets for the Department of Transportation, the Department of Administration, also went down because of that intent language on the sale of that property. And yesterday, the budget for a health and welfare division went down over concerns about EBT cards with $40 per month stipends for students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. This was a federal program specifically for summer months that enough lawmakers had concerns about that it went back, and the budget committee rewrote that yesterday afternoon without allowing for that pass through of those federal dollars.
Wow. And I know that you foreknow, but maybe not everybody else in the world does. The one thing that the Idaho legislature is supposed to do every year is pass the budgets. They don't have to really do anything else. That's the thing. It's in the Constitution, balanced budget, and go home. So budget bills usually are wrapped up before then, this, right?
Unlike the federal government, the state of Idaho has to spend only the money that it takes in for the year, or at least balance the books to make all the math make sense anyway. It's very unusual that specifically the Senate has voted down the number of budgets that they have over the last week, judiciary, transportation, health and welfare. The Senate typically does not vote down budget bills. Someone earlier today told me the last time they did it was in 2019. But they've been willing to do it over these policy issues. And it's really illustrating, I think, the politics at play between the House and the Senate right now.
Wow. Okay. So we'll have to wait and see what happens on the ITD sale next week. I guess this is stay tuned. There were other things that lawmakers debated over the last week. Mia, tell me about this immigration bill that's a copy of a Texas immigration bill. What is it? How does it work?
Hi, Samantha. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So House Bill 753, it was introduced just this week on Wednesday. And it's already made its way to the House floor. And what it is, it was sponsored by Representative Jaron Crane. He's a Republican in Nampa. And what the bill does is it would allow law enforcement to ask people to prove their documentation status. And if they were found to be undocumented, they would be first time found living undocumented in Idaho, they would be charged with a misdemeanor. And then if they were found again, if they didn't end up leaving their country and they already had that charge on their record, then they would be charged with a felony. This bill is an exact copy of a bill that passed earlier or late last year in Texas. It's just an Idaho version with Idaho institutions named in the bill. And that Texas law is not in effect because civil rights groups sued the state saying it's an overreach because it's the federal government's job to regulate immigration. So we're not really sure how this could play out in Idaho, but we had some law enforcement speak in favor of this bill, including the Kootenai County Sheriff. And then we also had civil rights groups speak against it, like the ACLU of Idaho, Poder of Idaho, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and the Idaho Dairymen's Association, all of whom argued that undocumented immigrants are an important part of Idaho's economy and that this is an overreach of the state government.
It'll be interesting to see, if we end up with more lawsuits.
Yeah, and I think that's a concern with a lot of bills going through the legislature. A lot of people testifying have that concern. Certainly at the Idaho Capital Sun, that's something that we're trying to keep track of. But it's definitely on top of people's minds.
Absolutely. Okay, Logan and Melissa, there was an anti-racism resolution that happened this week. And it tell me about this, exactly why this came up, what it was all about, This had one of those things where they call in everybody to vote, and pretty much you're trapped on the floor until you vote. Tell us about it. I love this part.
This is a fascinating and very unique parliamentary move that they pulled yesterday. But before we start there, as folks have probably seen in the news media, last week a visiting basketball team from the University of Utah participating in the NCAA tournament was staying at the Coeur d'Alene Resort, even though the tournament wasn't in Coeur d'Alene. That's where their lodging was. And they reported to local Coeur d'Alene police long story short, a racist incident is alleged to have occurred. And so this resolution was drafted and introduced at the State House yesterday, Thursday. It was introduced early in the day, and rules were suspended to take it up on the Senate floor in the afternoon. And it kind of lays out the situation, calls out Idaho's long history of combating hate groups such as the Aryan Nations in the past, going back into the 80s and 90s, and taking a very strong stance, denouncing racism and committing to, let me get this quote right, denounces the act of racism and commits to eradicating the conditions that allow racial animus and undue prejudice to persist in Idaho. So a very strong, very forceful statement. But they made the very odd thing where they issued what's called a call of the Senate, which
That's
is a
what
parliamentary
I was looking for.
Move.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an unusual parliamentary move. People may be tangentially aware of it because it's happened in Oregon more recently than it has in Idaho. The Oregon Senate, there have been walkouts in prior years that have like completely stopped them from being able to do work. So they've issued calls where they've actually sent police officers, to go arrest Oregon lawmakers and drag them back to do their work.
And I, if I recall, or some of the Oregon lawmakers came and hid in Idaho for a time, but that's
Oh yeah,
another story.
in Boise, I've heard, but yeah, we'll have another show about that.
Yeah.
Things did not get that heated in the Idaho Senate yesterday. The call only lasted for a little while. It did not involve any state police. It was just the Senate staff going to find the couple of lawmakers who were not in their seats during the roll call vote. And after that happened, a number of them stood up and the most conservative lawmakers in the chamber, I'll say, they kind of voiced some of the questions and doubts that have been going on social media of, well, we haven't seen any videos of this incident that is alleged to have happened, so why do we need to be rushing so quickly to denounce it when we don't quite have all the facts yet?
Melissa, it is unusual to have a call of the chamber in the Idaho legislature. And I was listening to some of the debate. Phil Hart, I think, said something about he wasn't sure what this was because it sort of came up at the last minute. But there's a lot of hesitation, I think, on some part of some of the lawmakers to have voted on this.
We heard some hesitation. We heard doubts that the incident even happened. We heard some whataboutism, like what about racism against white people? We saw that in a statement that Senator Lenny put out after he ultimately did vote yes, even though he sounded like he was debating against the resolution in the first place. The person who called in the incident in Coeur d'Alene apparently said something about white trash hillbillies or something like that, and he said that offends me, that that's racist. And so we heard the whataboutism. We heard all prejudice is bad. We heard Senator Tammy Nichols say something along the lines of, the best way to combat racism is to stop talking about it. Ultimately, only one senator voted no, Senator Phil Hart, who is from North Idaho. His district, if it doesn't cover that area, it borders it directly. And so I think it was a debate during which other senators stood up and forcefully said that they believe these women, that what happened was unacceptable, and that we need to stand up and denounce it. This follows Governor Little saying the same thing earlier this week. It follows legislative leadership from both the House and Senate, majority and minority parties, putting out a joint letter apologizing for what happened and saying that it was unacceptable. And so I think those who are spreading doubt are a minority, a vocal one though, and that overall the majority of lawmakers are pretty appalled by what allegedly happened.
Wow.
You know, Sam,
Go ahead, Logan.
I'll say hillbilly and I'll say redneck on the radio, but I won't say the other word. Phil Hart stood up on the floor of the Senate today and he voiced some more concerns, or he not concerns, but explanation for yesterday. He said that he's now had time to look at the incident. He knows more about the facts. He noted he is a University of Utah athletics alumni. So he said he was torn because he has a knee-jerk reaction to rise to the defense of University of Utah, but also being from North Idaho, a knee-jerk reaction to rise to the defense of the part of the state that he's from. So he said he was very torn and conflicted, and his no vote, the only no vote against the resolution today, he stood up on the floor and made the point that that was a no vote about the process and how quickly the resolution came up, not about the contents of it.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. It's been a fascinating legislative session so far, but I want to claw my way away from it for a minute and go to McCall. Don, let's talk about the McCall housing bond, which apparently is going to happen and going to be up for a vote. Tell me about it.
Gosh, Idaho State House or McCall. I'm going to have to think about which I'd prefer. So the McCall School District has been working on a project, as our Autumn Robertson has reported, to build some affordable housing for teachers. And this has run into a couple of barriers, including whether or not to bury a power line and some things like that. And the school district is as any employer is in McCall, crunched for housing. It's hard to find affordable places for people to live in Valley County, especially those who are trying to educate young people on the salary of a teacher. And so they've come up with what looks to be a novel idea, and that is they will put a bond on the ballot in May where voters can decide if they want to authorize a $14 million bond paid out over 15 years that would go towards building some affordable housing for teachers. And if passed, it would provide them a pathway to build these units adjacent to McCall Donnelly High School, which is, as most people probably know, just on the south, the southwest part of downtown. They've already built part of the project, but they don't have the money to get it across the finish line. And so the idea here is hopefully residents of the McCall Donnelly School District will say, sure, we'll give you another $6.50 a month in property tax revenue so that you can build housing for teachers.
As you said, it's a novel idea. But if, you know, if it passes, who knows, it might catch on.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it otherwise in other places. And of course, bonds are subject to the two-thirds majority provision in Idaho code, and bond issues in some places have worked just fine. The Boise School District passes bonds fairly regularly with lots of support. Other school districts have struggled. It would be interesting to see how bond issues focused on affordable housing for teachers would fare versus a facilities type of a bond. And, you know, it's not just for the benefit of the school district. Providing additional housing units of any kind in McCall would help because those teachers that they currently have are having to stay somewhere else, so they could open up a unit for somebody who's working at a restaurant or you know, at Shore Lodge or something like that. So it's a really interesting concept. It's not a lot of housing units. It's just 35 units, but 35 units in McCall to house teachers would be a big material difference there.
All right. We'll wait and see what happens with the bond. Let's go back to the legislature because we just can't stay away. I talk about postpartum Medicaid coverage, Mia and Christina. There are a few things that I'm going to go, huh, during this part of the chat. So first, tell me about what has passed. I believe it's passed all the way through.
Hi. Yeah, I can go ahead and start. Yeah. So this week, Idaho Governor Little signed House Bill 633 into law. And what that bill does is it extends postpartum coverage, Medicaid postpartum coverage, from 60 days to a full year. And that is set to take effect on July 1st. So this legislation is important because it was one of the recommendations that Idaho's former Maternal Mortality Review Committee offered in its final 2021 report. That committee was disbanded, but in its final report, they found that of the 17 maternal deaths that took place in 2021, most of those occurred while the individual was pregnant or within 1 year of pregnancy. So this legislation that is now, this law that is set to take effect, it's addressing that those facts. And also, according to the CDC, as of 2021, 41% of women across the U.S. had Medicaid as their insurance coverage at the time that they gave birth. So there is a significant chunk of women that could, you know, have 1 year rather than just 60-day access to postpartum coverage. They could have 12 years 12 months, sorry, not years. And also this was a bipartisan bill. It had support from medical groups and also groups like Right to Life of Idaho.
Christina, I think the part of this bill that shocked me was there only was 60 days of postpartum coverage.
Right. And Idaho was one of two states with that threshold, and the other being Arkansas, which has the highest mortality, death rate for women facing pregnancy in the United States. So I think the thing that has stuck with me as I've read more about this issue and studied it is that, you know, childbirth is so hard on the body, and women can develop things like diabetes and hypertension, which can become long-term things that they need to see a doctor about. And then there's also women that struggle with mental health issues like postpartum depression, anxiety, substance abuse after a child comes into their life. And so when you only have 60 days of access to, you know, a physician and mental health care, and after 60 days that's taken away, that's really when we start to see some of these problems crop up for women who have experienced pregnancy. And so elongating that timeline can be vital to making sure that these women have access to the care that they need after such a, you know, traumatic thing to happen to their bodies. So.
Wow. Okay. Good news there that more women will be able to take advantage of going to a doctor. But Melissa, you're going to tell me that there aren't going to be any doctors left for women and women's health care. You've been working on a panel this morning about that.
It's not that there aren't going to be any doctors left. It's that there is a shortage that we have been talking about for years now, but compounded by the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the abortion ban that went into place in Idaho. There are a number of OBGYNs, maternal fetal medicine doctors, and other women's healthcare physicians and professionals who have left the state, who are no longer working in those fields, and hospitals are also having trouble recruiting them. There was going to be a joint Senate and House Health and Welfare Committee meeting that was going to hear concerns from healthcare professionals about how the laws affect these shortages and what they hope lawmakers could do to address some of those concerns. That lawmakers canceled that joint hearing this week. And so we went ahead on Idaho Reports and invited a few of the planned speakers to share their concerns and what the situation is like on the ground, the consequences of these laws on not just physicians, but also ultimately how it might affect patient care.
And I forget whose fantastic reporting it was. Hopefully somebody can remember. But one of those trickle-down effects, I guess, if you want to call it that, that was reported on was a lot of the doctors who do come to Idaho to practice, just doctors in general, are younger and want to start families. And they're looking and seeing, without OBGYNs and other women's healthcare doctors here, they're deciding not to come. At least that was a possibility, if not reality. And so you're talking about even more of these effects that are coming into play.
Right. We heard multiple other trickle-down effects from people who were on the panel, Dr. Jim Souza, Dr. Megan Casper, who's an OBGYN practicing in Canyon County, and Susan Keller from the Idaho Medical Association. It doesn't just affect women who are actively pregnant. It affects it affects patients, both men and women, in so many different ways. And those trickle effects were really eye-opening. And a lot of it, you know, they drew a bright line from the problems that they're facing with physician recruitment, particularly in rural areas, to the uncertainty over how these laws are written and ultimately how they would be interpreted potentially by a prosecutor and a judge.
Okay. Where can we find out more?
That's going to air tonight on Idaho Reports. Idaho Reports airs 8 p.m. on Friday nights on Idaho Public Television, and it's available online after it airs at idahoptv.org.
Awesome. Logan, back to the legislature. And the University of Idaho is still trying to buy the University of Phoenix, and they had kind of a setback, I think it's fair to say, this week.
That's probably a fair description, Sam. Yeah, the proposed purchase of the University of Phoenix is an ongoing issue that the University of Idaho has been pursuing. Let's see, what do I need to mention here to make sure we have the right context? The university and the State Board of Education, which acts as the university's Board of Regents, they formed a nonprofit entity called 4-3 Education to facilitate this purchase and to eventually to manage the University of Phoenix with a degree of separation between the two institutions. The vision here is not to absorb the University of Phoenix into the University of Idaho, but to have it as an affiliate. And my understanding is they would keep all the Phoenix branding and everything else. But the lawmakers learned about this deal pretty much the same time as you and I and everybody else in the public did. It was a big surprise, which made a lot of them very upset and raised a lot of questions about transparency and just a lot of questions about the process. So there has been a lot of back and forth. There's been legislative action. The House last month pushed a resolution basically calling for the deal to be re-examined, if not scrapped, and threatening legal action against the university and the state board from the legislature if they don't get their way. That progressed through the House, whereas this week in the Senate, they were considering a different piece of legislation that really would have tried to salvage the deal and put it on more stable footing under the auspices of the state with some real actual formal approval from the legislature. And that bill was voted down in the Senate pretty unceremoniously. So that, as Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News has been doing a great job covering, it throws this questionable deal into even more uncharted waters.
Wow. Wow. And not unlike the debate over ITD buildings, there's some very, both sides are quite passionate about this debate, the folks who want the University of Phoenix and those who don't.
Yeah, certainly. And even some of the folks who say, well, there's some folks who are concerned about the purchase outright, but there are other folks who are supportive of the purchase, but are against it for those process and transparency reasons. So there's a lot of interesting coalitions of people with their own reasons for what decision they've come to.
Okay, so moving on to transgender care and Medicaid. Mia, tell us about this one. We're still in the State House. What is this and where did this all come from?
Yeah, so another law that Governor Little signed this week was one that will prohibit the use of public funds for covering gender-affirming care. So this means Idaho adults and minors enrolled in Medicaid or anybody that's on the state insurance plan would lose access to hormone therapy, puberty blockers, or surgeries. Although we have reported in the past that there are no physicians or surgeons in Idaho that do gender-affirming surgeries on Idahoans. So that law, and it's now signed into law and it's set to take effect in July. So this was another controversial law. A lot of its sponsors said that, you know, this bill is a way to make sure that Idaho taxpayers is all their money is being put to appropriate use. Meanwhile, opponents say that this bill discriminates against transgender Idahoans. So the bill, it doesn't explicitly say the word transgender, but it says public funds will not cover surgeries or medications, quote, to alter the appearance of an individual in order to affirm the individual's perception of their sex that is inconsistent with their biological sex. So the wording is kind of, it's very specifically worded. And so other people that need puberty blockers or hormone therapy, if they are not seeking those medications or treatments because they want to alter their physical appearance, they can still have access to those. Meanwhile, so basically a lot of people are saying like this law is singling out the transgender community. And a lot of people that testified were transgender state employees that rely on the state's insurance plan or that use Medicaid. One woman, she was a teacher in Caldwell, and she said, you know, her insurance is about to expire and she's looking forward to applying to a state job and she wants to buy a house in Idaho. She loves living in Idaho, but this bill would prevent her from, you know, achieving her dream because she does rely on gender affirming care. Another state employee, they work for the Department of Corrections, and they said, you know, I need this care. And a lot of medical associations, they support that gender affirming care is necessary for people. But you know, this has caused a lot of controversy. And another concern from opponents of this law is that they argue that this law potentially discriminates against transgender and Idahoans, and it could put Idaho at risk of another lawsuit that could cost the state millions of dollars. So once again, we're seeing lawsuits being a concern of people that are opposing these laws that are getting signed. So yeah, it's just something that we're going to probably keep covering and seeing its impact on Idahoans.
Especially if we get a lawsuit or two, you seem to be getting a lot of those stories. So this law is now, it's set to take effect on what, July 1st?
Yes.
Okay. Don, help me out. I want to go away from the legislature again. Getting a little depressed. Tell me about this new single size store. I have never heard of this. This is fascinating. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So I hadn't either. And if you pull the story up on our homepage at boisedev.com, you'll understand why. A store called Brandy Melville is now open at the Village at Meridian. And this is a retailer focused on fashion for young women, I would say primarily between about 16 and 24. And I've written a lot of stories about new stores opening over the years, hundreds, I would guess. And I've never had one that mentioned olive oil and Adolf Hitler in it. And you might sit back in your chair and go, what is he talking about? Brandy Melville has several hundred locations, and they are at the center of a new HBO documentary that will premiere next month called Brandy Hellville and the Cult of Fast Fashion. I'm going to actually read from my story so I get this right. The documentary uses a series of 2021 stories by Business Insider as its source material. One story claims employees of the stores are chosen and compensated based on looks. The story also claims the company required store-wide diets for employees, and other employees told the reporter they faced racism and saw Hitler memes shared by company executives. Brandy Melville also has a basically a single size policy. And so what that means is that each garment is only available in a single size of clothing. It's been related to me that that means, you know, like, well, there might be a kind of clothing for a larger person and a one for a smaller person, but you can't get like the same shirt in multiple sizes. We looked pretty closely at their website, and I could not find any clothing that was in available in any size other than small slash extra small, with the exception of a few like hoodies and sweaters that were described as oversized. My staff tells me that that's actually not that atypical. the store at the Village doesn't appear to have signs that some of the other stores carry, which say one size fits most. And one store in Europe, this is an Italian retailer, had designed its front door in such a way that oversized customers could not enter the store. The Boise store doesn't obviously have that, but there's certainly a track record of some things that are eyebrow raising about this. The olive oil reference is that the store, the chain, the brand, sells, you know, clothing and leggings and accessories and olive oil. Why I don't really fully understand, but they opened in February. It's the former Astro Gallery of Gems location, and that Astro Gallery moved around the corner at the Village.
It is interesting that that it does have some controversy around it. And I'm looking on your website. You have some pictures of some of the clothes, and we are talking about small and extra small. I mean,
yeah, very, very for very small young women, very petite young women.
Gotcha. Okay. Don, you're going to take us out today with a broken clock. I love this idea. I wanted to go get some sound from Back to the Future, but I just left it. Tell me about the broken Ann Morrison clock.
Yeah, the clock at Ann Morrison Park would go Back to the Future, but not the way you're thinking. this clock has stood kind of in the kind of south east part of the park for decades. It was initially built by the Daly family of Boise, and within a year, according to an old Idaho Statesman story I saw, stopped working. And they've been trying over the years to keep it working. I remember in the 1990s it had not worked for a long time, and there was a drive to fix it. City of Boise appropriated some money, and they took the old clock Face Off, which was a kind of an analog style, and then replaced it with this very 1990s digital green looking clock, and that didn't work either. And so the Daly and Morrison families have, as part of their ongoing project to revamp the park that carries Ann Morrison's name, have raised funds and plan to move the clock from its current location to a new, more prominent spot over by the fountain, which the foundation also just did, and restore the clock face to its original, more analog look. I should just note that Anna Daly, who is a reporter for Boise Dev, is a member of the Harry W. Morrison Foundation board, just for clarity. I didn't get this story from her, though. So it's a neat project that they're working to put together. The clock's kind of got a really unique look. The clock tower itself has two kind of crossing arms, and you've probably seen it. It's over by where they launch balloons now. But it's definitely in disrepair. I went and took a picture of it, and the face of it, the digits don't work, and it's rusted, and there's pieces that have fallen off over the years. And so this is one of those sort of long-standing icons of Boise that could get refurbished and also move to a more prominent spot.
Save the clock tower.
There you go.
But this won't cost Boise any money, right? This is all paid by the foundation.
The park is going through a number of improvements. Some of them are being funded privately by the Harry W. Morrison Foundation, as well as the Morrison Knudsen Foundation. Those are separate, both named for Harry Morrison, but as well as, in this case, the Idaho Heritage Trust. They also put in the funds for the fountain. The city is spending money on a new staircase that would go to connect the park to Peasley Street on the Boise Bench. It's kind of hard to get to Ann Morrison if you live on the Boise Bench, especially on foot right now. Mm. You have to kind of go all the way over to the Emerald and Americana side and come down, or you have to go to the Vista Capitol side. It's not actually that easy to get to the park. So that staircase would help give people, mostly on foot, on a bike too, but you got to take it up a lot of stairs. But so there's a whole bunch of improvements that are underway to really try and bring this park into its next phase.
And it's already got a new dog park that's been very popular.
And I will say, I went out there to take that picture, and I just was standing there this week thinking what an amazing asset it is to have these parks: Ann Morrison, Julia Davis, Catherine Albertson, Bernadine Quinn, and Esther Simplot parks, all near downtown, all along the river. If not for a lot of foresight by people decades and decades and generations ago, those wouldn't be open space. And so it's really nice to just have that open space so close to the middle of town.
And your pictures.
That's my soapbox for today.
No, I love that. Your pictures of the clock tower, save the clock tower, and of the move, the relocate, are all on boisedev.com.
Yep.
Wonderful. Don, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
We've been speaking with Don Day, the founder and editor of boisedev.com, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, Mia Maldonado, state politics reporter at the Idaho Capital Sun, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television. I want to thank everyone. I know it's hard to carve some time out, and you're doing it all for free for us, so thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.